Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. Until now, most medical treatments have been designed for the average patient. As a result of this one-size-fits-all approach, treatments can be very successful for some patients, but not for others. Precision medicine, on the other hand, is an innovative approach that takes into account individual differences in people's genes, environments, and lifestyles. It seeks to redefine our understanding of disease onset and its progression, treatment response, and most of all, health outcomes. This understanding will lead to more accurate diagnoses, more rational disease prevention strategies, better treatment selection, and the development of novel therapies. To date, progress in identifying optimal individualized treatments have been modest. Prospective cohort studies have the ability to identify biomarkers and factors that can contribute to future disease. The National Institutes of Health's Precision Medicine Initiative Cohort Program, PMICP, will build a large research cohort of a million or more Americans that will provide the platform for expanding our knowledge of precision medicine approaches that will benefit the nation for many years to come. What are the key strategic priorities for the PMICP? How do you balance accessibility and data security of cohort participants? How do you manage the expectations of the CMICP? We will explore these questions and so much more with our very special guest, Eric Dishman, director of NIH's Precision Medical Initiative Cohort Program. Eric, welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
Great to be here.
So would you provide us a brief overview of the history and mission of NIH's Precision Medicine Initiative, the Cohort Program?
Sure. I should start out by saying we shorten it to PMI, Precision Medicine Initiative. My understanding of it is that Dr. Collins started talking to the president and to other scientists even before that many years ago, saying now that the whole genome has been sequenced and the whole genome project is done and we continue to learn how to use, you know, that kind of data in both research and clinical practice, we really need to understand all the complex factors that come to bear on whether this individual at this moment in time is, you know, going to start an illness or a disease or what are their risks. And genetic information is certainly a piece of it, but you know, we know that your zip code is as important or more than your genetic code. And as this moment has occurred to where we have available in an affordable way everything from wearable technologies and the cost of sequencing is coming down, we have this opportunity to basically create the most diverse data set of the most diverse people at a large scale that we just couldn't do before. We didn't have the tools to capture the data. We didn't have the big data analytics tools to be able to process that data and turning it into either meaningful research results or into, you know, clinical practice. What do I do for this person standing in front of me right now? So the time is now and the time is ripe to actually, you know, ride those trends and figure out how to get this going. And then, you know, a little over a year and a half ago, the president put it into the State of the Union address and said, we are going to launch a precision medicine initiative. And as part of that, a cohort program that will invite a million or more people in America to donate. Initially it'll be blood and urine and their electronic health record data if they have it. And then over time, I mean, this is going to be a multi-decade relationship with people if we do this right, to look at the unfolding of and the complexity of what goes into are you as an individual healthy at this moment or not?
How is the, you know, I'm interested in the scope and scale of the cohort program. How is it organized? What's the size of your budget? And how many folks are actually helping you out?
I don't know the total number that are helping us out. My first 3 months have been really focused on just building the team out. There were so many people from different parts of government, FDA, the Office of the National Coordinator's Office, the VA, And then different agencies or different centers and institutes within NIH who have been basically in startup mode saying, well, how can we help, right? With, you know, sweep the floor as the janitor or work on the big national strategy, whatever needs to be done. And so now we're building that team out. But the real core of the startup team occurred back in July, right when I came to NIH, and we made the initial awards of about $55 million to 33 different organizations. And that was a mix of health provider organizations who will help us recruit people from their own membership, as well as the team, what we call the Data and Research Support Center at Vanderbilt, helped by Verily and by the Broad Institute. They are building out the huge data lake and data repository that we'll need, as well as all the tools that the researchers will need. And then the PTC, the Participant Technology Center, that's at the Scripps Institute and a software company called Vibrant Health. All of the capabilities that will be front-facing for volunteers, from the website, the 1-800 number, a phone-based way of entering the system, as well as since we're making this available to anybody that nominates themselves to say, I want to be part of this, how do we do a reliable blood draw around the country that's going to get a quality sample that we can use for science and research purposes anywhere in the country? So building out that capacity is a lot of what they're doing. So those 33 initial awardees are, I'm guessing there may be, you know, 400 or 500 people working across all of those as they ramp their teams. And then there's our federal partners within the Health and Human Services. The Veterans Administration signed a strategic partnership with us to help recruit into the PMI cohort program veterans who have already been part of the Million Veterans program as another way for them to actually give back. And this is an even richer data set than the one they're capturing there. So it's a small team and a big team, but we're also hiring like crazy to try to build out the capacity. This will be the largest that we know of biomedical research database in the world. And certainly the most diverse, and it'll take us, you know, a few years to get to 1 million people. But it's an audacious undertaking and incredibly exciting.
Yeah, it sounds it. I how is the? You kind of hinted at it, but is there? I'd like to get a sense of the research portfolio. Is there any research being done in house or versus external? And if so, how do they differ?
People will actually get confused when they hear about the PMI cohort program because they think we're actually doing all of the science. And really, we're building a platform that will allow thousands of other studies to occur on top of it. Now, it's not to say, I mean, there's different kinds of research questions we know it will help answer. You know, how do we estimate the risk for a range of diseases for somebody based on not just, you know, their family history, but their, you know, genetics, their electronic health record data, even, you know, data that's coming in from smartphones or wearables and those kinds of things. You know, over time, you'll see us do seed grants in certain areas, but the majority will be the rest of the institutes. We got to build something that's valuable for the rest of the National Institutes of Health to fund. We'll even be doing what I call research question workshops next year with a wide range of people from different fields of medicine, outside funders as well, saying, hey, this is your national resource upon which you will build and co-invest. You know, we're going to use taxpayer dollars to get 1 million diverse people's worth of data into a form that you can actually do research on top of it. In some cases, the science needs more than 1 million people. You know, in some case, a particular field may need one device that's so expensive we can't put it into the homes of 1 million people. Having other funders come and either do sub-studies from our cohort or, you know, work with us to get the cost down on a particular instrument or measure that they want to use so that 1 million people could do it. There'll be a lot of collaboration with industry, with academia, and with other funders over time as well.
So what is your job? Like being the director of this massive, audacious effort, could you give us a sense of your duties and responsibilities?
Sure. So, I mean, I am the director of the whole Precision of Medicine Initiative cohort program. I'm treating it as if I were still in industry. I came from Intel, and I said, you know, and I think this may be one of the reasons that I end up getting encouraged to apply. I joined the original working group more than a year and a half ago, just as an industry representative, and I did not know Dr. Collins, head of NIH, very well, but we happened to be sitting next to each other, and I whispered over to him and I said, you do realize that this is basically the NIH acting like a platform company because you're building out you know, I mean, I think of three platforms that we have to build. The first is an engagement platform. How do we engage a million people in a trusted relationship with, you know, feeding information back to them, giving them the option of learning about themselves and those that don't want to? How do you, you know, give people choice and a set of engagement that's going to keep people committed to this for decades to come? And that's the kind of things that, you know, marketing companies or consumer products companies know well, right? And then there's the acquisition platform. How do you actually acquire the data? The digital data, pulling in the electronic health record data from all the different EHRs that people's data may be in. And then how do you build the biobank that can capture this? We believe that we will capture ultimately more than 35 million vials of biosamples that are used for everything from, you know, chemical exposure studies to DNA studies and all points in between. The Mayo Clinic, who won the Biobank Award, is already breaking ground on new facilities to have the freezers that can house that data securely and safely so that people can come back and keep doing studies on top of this information for a long period to come. So acquiring the digital data and the physical samples. And the third is really the sharing platform. How can researchers from citizen scientists to, you know, the top tier universities in the country, none of whom can really afford a sample size this large, or to collect from that such a diverse population, because it takes quite an investment to really get all walks of America into this cohort program. So that data sharing platform is another big piece. So I really see as my job as a platform manager that can scale, that will be some of the most computationally intensive research that's ever done, as well as the, you know, we're doing research about the research. Like what are the best known methods for actually getting understudied and underserved populations to trust and come into a research study like this? They have historical reasons not to trust it, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, at some level, you know, evangelist, but platform manager. And I'm bringing from industry tried and true user experience methodologies, platform development processes and methods, and teaching those to government and academics and pulling in other companies who know how to do that. And the way to think about it is releases, right? If when we do this right, you know, you think of the people that get excited about the next iOS release from Apple or phone, right? Or the next, you know, Google Android operating system release. You know, imagine 18 months from now, we're doing the heart and lung release. And this is new data that is going to help advance the science of heart and lung, right? I want the participants, the public, and the researchers to all understand, hey, over the next 10 years, here's the kinds of things that we're going to be making breakthroughs on.
Wow, it's fascinating. So you mentioned that you were at Intel and you were in the working group. Would you tell us a little bit more about your career path? And more importantly, you know, what lessons have you learned in the technology world? And I think you hinted at it, that it will serve you in this new role.
Well, I mean, I have to admit, when I first had conversations with Dr. Collins and others that said, you should really consider applying, I literally looked behind me thinking they must be talking to somebody else, because I am not a PhD. I'm not a biologist. Even though a whole genome sequence helped to save my own life, my understanding of genetics and genomes is very, very thin. And, you know, Dr. Collins and others said, look, we have those world experts all around this campus in Bethesda. What we need is somebody that can come in and drive a very complex team for a very complex project that's, you know, consumer-facing, that's scientific-facing, that's provider-facing. And I think it was those early thoughts that I whispered, not knowing that this would lead to a whole new career path for me around platform thinking that was key. So I'm trained as a social scientist. I have helped invent and develop methods for 25 years in Silicon Valley on user-centered design. And how do you understand the needs of researchers or a wide range of participants and turn that into the definition of a product that can scale to millions and millions of people? And, you know, from how do you handle the security, because we'll be a big security target, right, to how do you add new features and capabilities without messing up everything that you've built before? How do you do the marketing and advertising to get to the messages to the audiences that you need? All of those things are part of what many industries and certainly the tech industry know how to do well. So that's, you know, part of what I'm trying to bring and really inculcate as an innovation culture right here within NIH.
Mm-hmm. So given your background, coming from the private sector and now this new, as you pointed out, and I think it is a very audacious effort, What makes an effective leader? And, you know, could you give us a sense of your leadership principles and perhaps who has influenced you?
Well, one of my key principles is surround yourself with people smarter than you. This is not hard for me to do in this particular case. So I'm trying to build out a staff. I still get intimidated walking on the NIH campus. And it's you know, you just look, you could throw a paper airplane and, you know, the person that it hits first may be somebody that's advancing brain science and the next person is somebody that's going to help eradicate the consequences of asthma, right? And they're mission-driven and unbelievable to do that. So certainly building an interdisciplinary team that is empowered. I'm not a czar. I don't believe in the czar model of leadership. I'm there to remove barriers for very smart people who work for me to get their work done. And then another big piece of me is transparency. At age 19, being diagnosed with cancer and facing your mortality, you know, from a very young age, I learned I didn't have time for BS in the world and I didn't have time to BS other people. I'm not very conflict-oriented, but I'm very open and very transparent. And we will be starting a blog. I will be starting a blog with the public and with the participants that are letting them know, hey, you know, we're on schedule for what we've been talking to you about, and here's what's going great. Or I might come and say a year from now, hey, we're going to be 3 months delayed on this particular piece of the study, and here's why, and I want you all to understand it, right? That level of directness, there's an equation that I was taught at Intel, S equals R minus E, success equals results minus expectations. So really managing people's expectations and helping them understand, the complicatedness of tasks and the reasonableness around when timelines are going to happen and so forth. And probably the third piece for me is iteration, learn as you go. The notion that you have a perfect plan is a false one, no matter how much time you spend planning. And there's nothing better than doing to know whether your plan is a plan that works or not. Andy Grove was one of my leadership leaders, the co-founder of Intel, and recently passed away. Dear friend in the last 7 years of his life. We worked together on wearable technology to try to make breakthroughs in Parkinson's, which is the disease that he had. We both had cancer and had met each other during our cancer phases. So, Andy was an extremely direct and transparent person. Everybody would always talk about, even in his last months, as he was reflecting on his career, and we'd be talking about Intel culture and Silicon Valley culture, so many of which try to model after him. You know, he was trying to, say, people in retrospect are turning me into this hero and as if I knew everything. And he's like, I learned as I went. You know, you had a good enough plan to get started. You iterate, you surround yourself with experts, and you're incredibly transparent and clear about what your goals are. And then you adjust and you continue to keep going forward. So, you know, the paintbrush of history is very kind. It makes it look like it was all thought through and you knew everything. And the reality is you learn in iterative ways. And you'll see that reflected in the way that we launch, right? We will not be an all singing, all dancing launch. We will launch pieces, test it, make sure the participants are loving it, the researchers can use it, the providers who are having their participants come in and say, should I be part of this study or have the proper education? And we'll, you know, it's not that we don't have a 5-year plan, but we know it will adjust based on reality on the ground, and you don't know it until you get started.
What are the strategic priorities for the PMI cohort program? We will ask its director, Eric Dishman, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.